Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the sun and fun capital of the world, and tonight it's the paranormal capital of the world. This is Dr. John Stamey, and welcome to another edition of ScaryCast. We're so glad to have everyone here tonight. We've got a great guest, we've got great co-hosts, and we're going to have a lot of fun. First of all, I want to introduce the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing, Dr. Trey?
I'm doing great, John. It was nice and cool this evening on the porch. My son is in Montana, and he said it's 95 there. So how about that for a flip from South Carolina to Montana?
Well, heck with that. I mean, we'll stay in South Carolina, okay?
I know.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, we're glad to have you here, and just tell him he can bring his. Doesn't he have a girlfriend or a fiance or something like that?
Yes, fiance.
He can just bring her down here to South Carolina, and they can chill
and
out
off into the 80s.
That's right. Say heck with that 95 degree stuff. Let's come on down here to South Carolina. That's great. But anyway, glad to have you here, and in this beautiful weather that we're having. That's all I got to say. We're so glad we're not near Lake Mead, because there is almost no Lake Mead now, but that's okay. And we've got from Houston, Texas, the one and only Kyler Smith. Kyler, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm finally relaxing after the weekend of moving all our stuff in. Still got some stuff to unpack, but I'm doing good.
That's right. So that everyone knows, Kyler and his brother had to move everything, and they learned a valuable lesson that I learned 2.5 years ago. Just go ahead and hire a moving company. Just don't do it yourself. It'll kill you, right, Kyler?
Oh, yeah. I'm a little sore.
I'm sure you are, but we're glad you're here with us, and that's great. And our guest tonight, it is the first Monday of the month, and we've got John LeMay, the celebrated paranormal author. He writes books on UFOs, on hauntings, on all kinds of cool stuff. And John LeMay from Roswell, New Mexico, thanks for being here tonight. How are you?
I'm good. I'm always happy when it's this time of the month. Time to go on ScaryCast.
Well, thank you very much. We're always glad to have you here. It's going to be kind of a fun show. We've got lots of interesting stuff to talk about. And the first one, I guess we're going to talk a little bit about UFOs, and then we're going to talk about a brand new magazine that you're putting together. And somehow you asked a dude from Myrtle Beach to write a story, and it was very kind of you to put it in there. And so thank you. And then we're going to talk about an event coming up in Ruidoso, which is a fairly short drive from Roswell. And we'll talk about that. So anyway, just tell us in general, what are you researching these days, and what's going on in the research and paranormal world of John LeMay?
I'm just researching all sorts of things. You know me, like those vampire witches from down in Mexico. I just got a book on that called Bloodsucking Witchcraft, which is really interesting and thorough. Then I was prepping articles for that magazine we talked about, and all sorts of different stuff.
Well, that's great, because we know you've got a lot of interesting things going on. So anyway, I want to jump right now to this magazine. I think you called me, wasn't it, a little less than a week ago? No, it was about a week ago. And you called me and you said, John, I have an idea. So do you want to kind of tell us a little bit more about this idea?
Yeah, so I've been flirting with the idea of doing a kind of a weird type Western magazine for a little while, you know, because they back in the 60s and the 70s, they had a bunch of old pulp Western magazines that were a lot of fun. And the reason I thought they were so much fun is they were basically just full of tall tales and half-truths. Whereas today, you know, everybody's obsessed with the truth. Like, you know, that's why the magazine today is called True West. They like it all to be true, but I like the stuff that's, you know, probably not true or it's hard to believe, you know, and might be true, but it's just really out there. So I was flirting with this idea of kind of a Western little digest magazine like that. And, you know, it was just percolating in my head. And Dr. John sent me a short story he wrote on a whim about Ambrose Bierce. And, you know, I was looking at the story and I thought, well, I wonder if John has anywhere to publish this. And if he doesn't have anywhere to publish it, I'm going to kind of take it as a sign that it would be perfect for my little magazine I'm thinking of, because that would give me some content to put in there other than just articles written by me, you know, because I needed some other contributors and stuff. And so when John said he just wrote it for fun and hadn't, you know, decided where to publish it yet, I thought, well, I think that's kind of a sign to just go through with it. And since then, John and I have been kicking around names for the magazine. It's still not entirely sure which one. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go with Strange West, because it's just simple and nice and that gets the idea across. So this first issue, it's lined up to have an article on the Tombstone Thunderbird, which I know everybody's heard of, but this article is going to have kind of some new, I don't know if you could call it new evidence, but it's going to have some new information at least on the Tombstone Thunderbird, which is cool. It's going to have a little article on a mummy from Las Vegas, Nevada. It's got a write-up from the old Federal Writers Project from back in the 1930s, where this old-timer claimed that he met Jack the Ripper in Benson, Arizona. It's got an interview with Donna Blake Rachel, who wrote Haunted Hotels and Ghostly Getaways of New Mexico. And it's got a big, big article on Ambrose Bierce. So a lot of stuff in there.
Now, you just mentioned something about Jack the Ripper. And I have got one of my very best friends in North Carolina. He's got a series of books, and they're about this disease that takes over people and it turns them into vampires. But actually, Dave is a former number one on Amazon author for this series, and so he's got a book about Jack the Ripper. And John, would I be able to introduce you to Dave? At some point, I think you'd find him fascinating, and he knows a lot about Jack the Ripper, and he's got some interesting stories about Jack. In fact, he's got an entire book about Jack the Ripper and what he calls the hunger. It's kind of a vampire kind of thing where they have to, you know, they have to suck blood and all this stuff to stay alive. Sounds like vampires, doesn't it?
Oh, and that'd be great, and I bet he's already got the – this story of Jack the Ripper in Benson, Arizona. It's not real common, but since he's into Jack the Ripper, hopefully he's read it. And, you know, I don't know if I believe it or not, but it's, you know, I mean, you can't pass up a story about Jack the Ripper escaping England to come here to the Old West, especially since nobody really knows what happened to him. So,
you know, what did happen to him? Don't you often wonder what happened to Jack the Ripper? I mean, the dude is there in all the fog and all the everything, killing girls. And where did he go? What did he do? I mean, did he get aboard a ship? Did he come over here? I mean, John, I'm going to ask you a question that a lot of people probably haven't asked you. What do you really think? And just give us your opinion. It's an opinion question. But what in the heck do you think happened to Jack the Ripper?
I don't know, because I haven't really looked into it hard enough. But this little Benson story, it just basically goes that there was a rumor around town that the bartender was really Jack the Ripper, and he got into a fight with the owner one night, and he got shot during the fight, the alleged Jack the Ripper, and his dying confession was that he was Jack the Ripper who fled from England. And there's only just one witness testimony to go on for that whole story, though. And when you've only got one witness, you know, that makes it It doesn't make the credibility so good, but it's a great story. But I don't really know enough about Jack the Ripper lore in general to even have an opinion. You know, it just seems like to me he quit killing, or if he didn't quit killing, they quit finding the bodies or whatever. But, you know, he quit making headlines and just kind of disappeared because they never knew who he was to begin with. So that's a tough one.
Okay, well, I just wanted to ask. I mean, I think the story of Jack the Ripper is, it's like an eternal story. It's like one of the true serial killers that we never found. And, I mean, we found, or we think we found other serial killers. We certainly have found Jeffrey Dahmer. We found these folks. And then, of course, we have the mystery serial killers. And I guess I will go ahead and mention tonight, because last night was an event in the pop culture of America. Ric Flair was live and did his last match. And did anyone on here see it? John, did you see it?
No. Uh-uh.
Trey Dunaway, did you see Ric Flair's last match last night?
No.
Kyler Smith, did you see Ric Flair's match last night?
I definitely did not.
Well, I'll tell you, it was a match for history. It really was. At 73 years old, he got out there and tore it up. And he did what he was supposed to do, is he put Jeff Jarrett in the figure four leg lock. He was bleeding like a stuck pig. It was like everything that everybody in the world ever wanted to see from Ric Flair. And it closed a chapter in wrestling. I mean, because Ric Flair is, to be honest with you, he is the Arnold Palmer of wrestling. He is the guy that brought wrestling and television together, and he made it so popular. And, you know, we had just like a great story was told last night. And it was. It was great. It was very, very interesting. And then, you know, you talk about stories. You've got the story of Jack the Ripper. You've got now, and the reason I picked Ric Flair was to get into the wrestling world about murders and serial killers. And you've got the great story of Chris Benoit. Now, I don't know if everybody knows that, but we had a Murder 123 episode. And Dr. Trey, were you on there when Maestro kind of accidentally spilled the beans? Chris Benoit was a very, very famous wrestler, very accomplished, and he has been intimated into killing his wife and his autistic son. And now, Dr. Trey, were you on that Murder 123 when we did it?
No, I don't think I was on that one.
Okay, well, Maestro, the great professional wrestler who is our close friend, said, Kevin Sullivan said this was a setup. And Kevin Sullivan had been a tag team partner of Chris Benoit's. And Kevin Sullivan is not a dumb man. And so we have lots of interesting stories about serial and somewhat pseudo serial killers. And so we have Jack the Ripper. And we don't know, and we even did a story on Jack the Ripper on Murder 123. And we said, well, it could have been one guy who killed a number of ladies, or it could have been several men who killed a lady or two apiece. We do not know. But it's just very interesting how things happen. And I want to hear more about, in fact, John, Didn't you maybe go into this story? It was, what, Benson, Arizona?
Yeah, that's where it took place.
And didn't you maybe go into this one time when you've been on here before?
Oh, about Jack the Ripper? Probably so. We probably talked about it when we did Cowboys and Monsters, the book.
Right, and it's like it could have been one person who killed several ladies, or it could have been several men who copycat killed. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden he shows up in Arizona. Well, you know what? Who knows? And it might be the case. And you truly have, you know, what do you think the odds are that a deathbed confession is true? Now, I'm going to ask all of our panelists and you, John. In fact, Trey, I'm going to start with you first because you are a doctor. You have been with people when they have died, correct?
Yes.
What do you think about the veracity and or the truth of a deathbed confession? What has been, I mean, I know this is kind of out of left field, but I think it kind of ties in. What do you think about a deathbed confession, the truth or not?
Well, most of my patients have not been particularly chatty when they died because they've been very ill or a traumatic death. But I think if somebody takes the time, know they're about to leave, I think they're not going to certainly get any personal gain from it. And as long as they're not getting personal gain for their family, I think I tend to believe them. I mean, what do they have to lose?
I agree with you. They have nothing to lose. And in general, when they're going, I'll say this, and everybody can please forgive me if you don't like this comment. But when you're getting ready to meet your maker, I don't think you're going to lie. Does that, Dr. Trey, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Kyler, what do you think? Do you think someone that's getting ready to leave this earth and go meet their maker, do you think they're going to be a liar? What do you think?
I don't see the reason to, so no, absolutely not.
Well, John, that's kind of what the ScaryCast hosts think. We don't think that someone's going to lie when they're getting ready to meet their maker because this is the most incredible moment of their lives, and it's going to end it. So it seems like they're probably not going to lie. So what you're saying is this gentleman in Benson, Arizona, said that he was Jack the Ripper, and he said that on his deathbed, correct?
Yeah. So to be clear, you know, rather than like a deathbed, he'd been shot in this, you know, exciting bar fight. So he was just, you know, bleeding out on the ground and claimed that he really was Jack the Ripper, just like everybody said he was. So I agree with Trey and Kyler that deathbed confessions are generally true. And my question would be, did this incident happen at all? You know, I mean, if the deathbed confession is real, sure, then maybe he really was Jack the Ripper. But the problem with these old timers that the reporters would interview as part of the Federal Writers Project, some of them would just make stuff up or kind of tell tales that they had heard and place themselves in them like they happened to them. So I just have no idea of the veracity of the story to begin with. You know, that's more the problem than anything, because it seems like the one old man who told the story was just passing through Benson one night. And I don't think anyone from Benson has ever told any of these Jack the Ripper stories. It was just this guy who randomly passed through town and happened to be there on the right night when this alleged gunfight happened with Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I think it would be tough to get. I mean, this was in the 18. When was Jack the Ripper? Like 1850s, 1860s, something like that.
So this particular story was like the early 1900s. I think it was before the 19-teens. It was just 1900-something. I can't remember the exact date, but just the first decade of the 1900s for the Benson story. And I think Jack the Ripper did his killing in England in like the 1880s, I'm pretty sure.
I'm looking it up. Yeah, 1880s.
Wow.
I doubt if many people travel from London to go to Arizona just to die in a bar fight, though. That seems
now,
kind
Trey,
of a...
you know something funny, though? they imported the entire London Bridge to Arizona. I think a lot of people forget that. I mean, this was later in the 1960s, but the original London Bridge is actually in Arizona now.
That's right. Exactly right.
Oh my goodness. That's a good thing to say, John. I mean, because it really is. And you know, who knows? And I think just the notion of the deathbed confession is a little bit of an interesting thing, because we've got four opinions about deathbed confessions. And does anybody really know of any research on deathbed confessions? I think that's we've got Dr. Raymond Moody's book on life after life, and that might be a good place for me to start. But the idea of a deathbed confession is really interesting. It's like, well, who's going to lie on the deathbed confession when you're getting ready to meet your maker? And I guess that's the whole point. So we'll see. And John, maybe you and I can talk a little bit about this. Don't you think it's a little bit of an interesting topic?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there's been plenty of Roswell incident witnesses. Well, maybe I shouldn't call them Roswell incident witnesses, but there's been plenty of military guys who never ever spoke of the Roswell incident until their deathbed. Then all of a sudden, when they know they're going to die, they come out and say, yeah, it happened. There was a flying saucer and all of it. I can't remember their names, but I know there's been a few that have done that.
Yeah, it's not like they're going to get thrown into jail. So,
yeah.
You know, I can see that. Pretty straightforward.
And you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because this weekend, I don't know if you folks are familiar with it, but you know, when you're on someone that's got the deluxe cable network thing and they've got 800,000 channels, I was at my buddy Mike's house, and we were on Saturday night, we were looking for paranormal stories. And we found AHC, the American History Channel. It was incredible, and they had several shows talking about this exact thing. And what they were doing is they were just going over things like they were making up facts. Like, well, since Roswell happened in 1947, all of a sudden we have lots of 1948 and 49 UFO sightings. Now, John LeMay, is it true that no UFO sightings happened before 1947? You know, this is a made-up question, and I asked you this before.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
Well, John, I mean, didn't you basically, like you just said, the so-called experts on that show kind of, they claim that there were no real UFO sightings before 1947, right? That's what they were trying to claim in like a skeptical manner. Yeah, I mean, that's just such hooey, because there's tons and tons of UFO cases prior to that. I mean, they might just be referring to the fact that Kenneth Arnold saw UFOs on June 24th, and that was when the term flying saucer was first coined, and that's when the media really exploited them and they really caught on. But prior to that, all throughout the 1800s, throughout ancient history, you know, people have seen strange craft in the sky. And the big flap prior to 1947 was exactly 50 years before that. I'd never actually thought of that before, so... precisely 50 years ago in 1897 is when they had this huge airship flap, where newspapers were just reporting on airships pretty much once a week, where they would see them fly over the town, or they might crash, like in the case of Aurora and a few other places. The only big difference was with those airships back in the 1890s is they kind of resembled more so like futuristic blimps or dirigibles. Not very many of them were flying saucers, aside from just a few special cases. But, I mean, to say that people didn't see things in the sky prior to 1947 is just crazy, because my friend and I know a tourist who's a ufologist in Texas. You know, we do a whole series on historical UFOs. We've done a book on UFOs in the 1920s. We've done one on UFOs in the early 19-teens. You know, for instance, NOE even found a story about how some of the survivors of the Titanic sinking claimed that they saw strange lights flying through the sky, kind of as if they were observing them. You know, so there's just UFO sightings in every single era of history, and it's fascinating.
Right. And you know, it's a shame that they didn't just stop the sinking and do something about it, but they didn't. But anyway, yeah, there's lots of stories, and there's lots of skeptics that just want to say, well, it didn't happen, but it did. And, you know, it's very interesting what skeptics want to say. They want to rewrite history. In fact, a lot of people want to rewrite history. They're trying to rewrite history right now by taking down statues. And I'm sorry if that's a very unpopular topic, Dr. Trey, because you're a guy that follows the news a lot. Do you see a lot of rewriting of history right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it depends on which side you're on. You can have somebody say something in the Senate, and the Republicans and the Democrats are going to all—it's all going to be different. So that's just the marvel of news, where you just find it so opinionated, it's going to flip it from one way to another. So we can't even get current events straight, let alone history. And when you look at, and when you truly look at history, when you look at big changes in history, you know, with my bend toward Revolutionary War, most people are shocked, amazed, just stunned when they find out how much Revolutionary War activity went on in South Carolina. Most people don't think of it that way. Well, there was more battles and fought in South Carolina than any of the other colonies with the British. There were more, a third of all the wounded and injured and killed in action was in South Carolina. In South Carolina, and you say, well, how many big battles? Well, the two largest losses occurred in South Carolina for the Patriots. So a huge amount of history. But when the Civil War came along, all that Revolutionary War patriotism in the South was vanished. Northern publishers and Northern authors just kind of dropped that out of Southern lore. And so that's why when people hear about the Revolutionary War in South Carolina, they're always kind of amazed that there was that much. Well, it's because after the Civil War, Southern patriotism was discounted. So, oh yeah, it changes all the time. Depends on who wins the war.
Right. That's very interesting that you said that, because, you know, it really happened. Things change. Politics change. News changes. People that write change a lot of what goes on. And it's amazing. So, and John LeMay, I guess, you know, what's interesting is, okay, so we're watching this one show about UFOs on this AHC network, and they're talking about a great UFO occurrence in England, the Rendlesham Forest. Now, I don't know if everybody knows about this, but Rendlesham Forest, one night at Rendlesham Forest was very near an American, I guess it was an Air Force base in England. And they saw something. They thought it was a plane going down. They sent a couple of guys out, and all they saw was this ball of light that just was messing around with them. And then it landed. One guy touched it, and that's all they reported. Two nights later, they reported the same thing. They had a larger group of people go out. They saw it, and that was it. Now, what's interesting is the rewriting of history. What's most interesting about Rendlesham Forest is that the gentleman that touched the UFO the very first time, he got a communication, and it was all in zeros and ones. He wrote it down, and believe it or not, it actually makes sense. And it talks about contacting us from the future, from the year 8400. And the fact is, they wanted to ignore that. That was the single most important thing that happened with Rendlesham Forest. It's a very, very famous thing, but yet they're wanting to rewrite it, and let's forget about this now. And we have too many times that we want to rewrite history. We want to rewrite history with Chris Benoit, the wrestler who was accused of murdering his family, and then he died. And so it was easy to, well, from what I can tell you, is Fayette County in Georgia, they closed that case in 24 hours. It was a travesty. They just wanted to do it. It's like, there have been so many times that our media and the law enforcement want to close cases immediately so that we don't talk about them. And sorry. That's kind of like my personal viewpoint, but I've seen it happen, I guess. I'm going to shock everyone. I'm old enough. I've seen it already. So I just keep seeing it happen, and that's what they did. So anyway, all right, Kyler Smith, do you have any comments that you'd like to make here before we go to a station break?
Yeah, I just think it's funny. Like what you were just talking about, they like to close cases as fast as possible just to have no one to talk about it, which actually works as a counter effect, because if they close it that fast, it makes us even more curious, like, okay, now actually what's happening? Because you wouldn't do that if something wasn't going on. So, yeah.
And in fact, we have evidence right here, Gary Cast Network, from shows that we have produced, that there are strange things that have gone on with murder cases and that people don't want to talk about them. So, I mean, if you want to give me a call, 843-655-8775, or send me a message on Facebook, and I'll be glad to direct you to some of these episodes that we've had. We've got some great commentary from some folks that really know what they're doing. So anyway, back in 1 second, we'll say thanks a lot to Transamerica, the great life insurance company, and WLSC AM and FM Myrtle Beach, Conway, and Laura, South Carolina, for having us on there every midnight. And if you're listening to us midnight on tigerradio.com, WLSC, thanks a lot. We're glad to have you here. So, John LeMay, we're going to, like, come back to you because you've always got interesting things to tell us. What more interesting things are you looking at that you'd like to share with us?
Well, let's you and me both talk about Ambrose Bierce some before we run out of time, because I've got a lot on Bierce. But I thought, you're such a Bierce fan, you're more passionate about him than I am. Why don't you just give people who don't know about him just a quick little refresher on who he is, why he was famous, why he was a big deal. Then I'll talk about how he maybe disappeared.
Okay, well, let me tell you how I even got in touch with Ambrose Bierce and how I learned about him. When I was a professor at Coastal Carolina University, I had a student named Thomas Ambrose Bierce. And he was in my office one day, and I said, "Are you related?" That's all I said. He said, "It's like my great-great-granduncle." I said, "Are you kidding? He is one of the greatest American authors of all time. He's written some of my favorite stories and everything." He said, "You know about him? You're the only person at this university that's ever heard of Ambrose Bierce." That's what he said. Of course, wasn't much of a student. He probably hadn't been to the English department. But still, we had a very lively discussion. And what's important about Ambrose Bierce is, number one, he was the leading intellect in the United States from probably 1885 until about 1910, when he supposedly passed away. Number one, he wrote a book, one of the most fantastic books of all time. It was called The Devil's Dictionary. And what he did was he took interesting phrases or just things that we know about, and he gave them a political and satirical spin. So his, what it turned out to be a book, because these were columns that he wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. And it turned out to be a book. It turned out to be a huge bestseller. I mean, you know, when we talk about bestsellers in 1900, well, you know, a lot of people don't remember that because that's 122 years ago. But still, Ambrose Bierce was a giant in American literature. He wrote a couple of hundred short stories, and he wrote my favorite short story, which was one page long. It was called The Problem in Crossing a Field. Well, it's a shame that the Queen of Scary Cast, Robin McRae, is not here. Because what happened, it's a story about a plantation owner who walked across the road, and he was walking through his field, and his neighbors were coming through there, and they said, hello, how's it going? And all of a sudden, the gentleman in this story vanished. And he could, and for a moment, he could still hear them, but he was gone. And what Robin would probably say is that he stepped into a portal. Well, the rest of the one-page short story is all about the fallout, guy vanishing. And it's a great story. In fact, I told Kyler to take a look at that. Kyler, did you have a chance to look at this story?
I did, yeah. Sorry, I had it on mute. I was trying to multitask.
Isn't it kind of a strange story that a man just vanishes in front of everybody? I mean, what do you think about
that? I was a little confused at first because it didn't really come out and say it, but yeah, it took me the second time to read it over. Like, it didn't really make sense, but I mean, yeah, I didn't really know what to think.
Well, nobody knows what to think unless you look at a very modern interpretation, a very modern paranormal interpretation that, well, my goodness, we're talking about somebody has walked into a portal. There are many portal stories of people who have disappeared on Mount Shasta. I mean, they've just gone ahead of their crew and they've vanished. Well, what we can say is they've probably gone into a portal. So we don't know what to say about this, but Ambrose Bierce is the first American author, and he set this in 1854, but he wrote it, I think, in 1890 or 1891, and it was published in the San Francisco Chronicle. But the fact is that Ambrose Bierce talked about the idea that someone could vanish directly in front of everyone, and I don't know, that's kind of a very modern idea of something that could happen. So, you know, Ambrose Bierce was well ahead of his time, John LeMay. I'm gonna go back to your question. He is very well ahead of his time. He wrote many horror stories, but that is the one that sticks in my head as the strangest one because it's almost like something that could happen today. It's like something that could happen on Mount Shasta. Or it could something that could happen in Costa Rica, because there are people that seem to vanish in Costa Rica. There really are. So it's like, what the heck do you say? The man was well ahead of his time. He was a genius. And he wrote the Devil's Dictionary. So, I mean, what can you say? Back to you, John LeMay.
Yeah, so now I'll tell you how I came across Bierce was through a book by one of my favorite paranormal authors named Brad Steiger. He's written some really cool stuff. This particular book, if you want to find it, is called Montezuma's Serpent. And the whole book isn't about Montezuma's Serpent. It's just one of those books of, just collected chapters. Each one deals with something different. And I think Montezuma's Serpent was just like the coolest chapter in the book, so they let it have the title. But one of the chapters in the book is all about Bierce and how, you know, Steiger makes the case. What are the odds that this guy who wrote the most famous short story in the world for a person who just vanishes into thin air, you know, what are the odds he himself vanishes without a trace? And Steiger made an interesting point that Bierce was friends with some scientists from back in his day. I forget his name. It was like a German name or something. But this scientist had his own theory about something he called vacua, or just spaces within our space that someone could fall into and fall into another dimension and just disappear. And it's thought that Bierce, you know, probably that was the theory on his mind when he wrote his short story. But, you know, Steiger, I think just for fun, kind of concluded his chapter kind of like, well, you know, maybe Bierce, you know, stepped into a vacua and disappeared. And I really liked that. I wanted to believe that, and I wanted to find something of more sustenance on that theory, that what if Bierce did, you know, step into like a wormhole or something? Well, so then I'm talking to Dr. John about it, and Dr. John told me his theory that he says, or you said, you know, you think Ambrose Bierce went into a cave and he met the devil, which seems kind of off the wall, but it's not. Ambrose Bierce in 1913, very late winter of 1913, around Christmas time, he decided to do a tour of all his old Civil War battlefields. And he was leaving his home and he was heading south, but he eventually made it as far south as Mexico, because his last two surviving pieces of correspondence to his daughter and his secretary both state that he's going down to Mexico for a reason he cannot disclose. Here's what he said. He said, I'm going down to Mexico for a definite purpose, which I cannot disclose. And there's where you basically lose any hard, solid evidence of where Bierce went. But there are lots and lots of stories that say that Bierce went to, maybe he was too old to really fight with Pancho Villa, but he went to basically ride with Pancho Villa and chronicle the Mexican Revolution, which was in full swing by 1913. And there's quite a few oral traditions from Mexico that say that he was there, and there's a ton of different ones. One of them say that he was executed by firing squad for some reason. I can't remember what it was. But definitely one of the last spots where he was allegedly seen was the Battle of Ojinaga. And Ojinaga is basically across the river from the Big Bend in Texas. So it's, you know, it's a border town. And they had a big battle there very late in December, and it kind of it stretched into January of 1914 and really intensified. And, you know, the more boring story is that Bierce was just a casualty of this battle. And they say that his body was burned to avoid a typhoid outbreak or something. Who knows if that's true? But, you know, I was always remembering back to Steiger's thing about, well, what if he disappeared? And then I remembered back to Dr. John's theory about him meeting the devil. Well, what are the odds that in Ojinaga and the Big Bend region, there is Devil's Cave? And there's a lot of Devil's Caves in Mexico. There's probably at least a dozen of them. And they're all very similar. What happens is if you go into one of these Devil's Caves, okay, there's a lot of folk tales where you'll have like a sheep herder or a little boy. They'll walk into the cave, and sometimes they'll meet someone who's kind of like the devil, who will wine and dine them, and they have a great time in this cave, and they're only in there for an hour, and then they step back outside and they return to their village, and they find out that they have been missing for an entire year. Like I said, there's several of those in Mexico, and they're almost always just called Devil's Cave or whatever. Well, the one in Ojinaga, also called Devil's Cave, there's a big legend around it that, you know, the devil lived in this cave, and he used to come down and terrorize the village until this priest finally had enough, and he built like a special charmed crucifix that he used to seal the devil forever into his cave. And it's a big deal in Ojinaga. They still talk about it. And the cross is still there. They built a chapel around the cross. And, you know, they will actually take this special cross down on, they have kind of like a holy feast day. I think they call it Holy Day of the Cross in early May, you know, which is basically a springtime festival where they take down the cross and they hope it'll help bless their crops. But they have this fear, though, that when they remove the cross for the festival, that the devil will escape. And they have stories that on days when they take the cross down to tour the country is when they see like strange monstrous animals or a witch or just something supernatural. There's lots of stories like that around Big Bend, Ojinaga, and all that. So, you know, I just think it's funny that what are the odds that Ambrose Bierce disappears in an area that is so famous for having the Devil's Cave. And the other part of the legend I forgot to mention was that the devil had a big giant ball. He would come down and terrorize the villagers with this big steel ball, and he would use it to like crush things and roll them over people. And Ojinaga actually has, I mean, what's probably frankly just a replica, but they have a big yellow ball somewhere in the center of town that is supposed to be, you know, the same devil's ball, just like they have the same devil's, well, not the devil's cross, but the cross to keep the devil in the cave up on the chapel on the hill. So, I mean, that's the spot where Ambrose Bierce disappeared. And it's like, you know, what are the odds? What if he went into that cave and he did disappear forever? And that's kind of the story that Dr. John wrote.
And so here is the story. John, may I tell the story?
Oh, yeah.
It's called, you know, if there's the problem with crossing a field, then there's the problem with entering a cave. And what happened was there were a couple of soldiers that were trying to find him, and he got behind a large rock next to a cave, and he shot him. And he went out there, and he picked their pockets clean, like any good thief. Ambrose Bierce was kind of like a really cool guy. He knew what to do. He knew how to handle life. So he went out there, he picked their pockets, he got a couple of gold coins, got a couple of silver coins, and then he heard these other troops that were coming to find out because they had heard them shoot. They'd heard him shoot somebody. So what he did was there was a cave right behind him, so he ducked into the cave. And it was cool because it was very, very hot in Mexico at that time. So he goes in there, and it's cool. And he sees a light kind of at the end of the tunnel. So he walks toward it, and he keeps walking, and the light gets brighter. And he's entertained. So he keeps walking toward the light. Then all of a sudden, he sees a man standing in front of him. But the man, he was 74 years old at that time, and the man that he saw looked like himself, 35. So he wasn't too frightened, but he said, well, who are you? He said, well, who do you think I am? And then all of a sudden, the man vanishes, and he touches him from his back. He turns around, and the man looks, it's the same man, but he's got horns, and he's like flushed red. And has a tail. Then all of a sudden he touches him from the other side. He's back in front of him, looking like Ambrose Bierce. Well, Ambrose knows that he's now met the devil. And that was what happened was Tom Bierce was in my office, and the story just came to me. And I told him the story. He said, oh, that's a great story, whatever. And he left. And I saw this happen. And so I hadn't thought about this story for years, and probably about 15 years. And then John LeMay talked to me a little bit about the magazine and said, well, we should do an Ambrose Bierce thing because I've got this story. He said, really? He said, write it up. And I did. And he liked it. He liked the first half. And then as if by magic, the second half happened. I'm not going to tell anybody what happened. But those of you that get the magazine, it's going to be interesting. And it's like the second part happened because I needed to find out what happened to Ambrose Bierce. So you'll see. And just remember, it's all because he was sent what did they say in the Blues Brothers? He was on
mission from God.
He was on, that's right. He was on something from God. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting how it all turned out. It's like I needed the ending, and the ending just showed up, and there's also a little Devil's Dictionary thing in there. So it's a very interesting story how it was written. I loved it. I sent it to John. John liked it. Thank you very much. I'm glad you're going to put it in the book. and we're going to have a lot of fun. We'll be promoting this magazine. As soon as you get the name, we'll do it. And also, the minute we started talking about it, I said, John, this is a Comic-Con. We've got to put together an event where people can come and see the paranormal. They can see steampunk. They can see the wild, wicked, cruel, odd, weird West. Maybe it's the strange West. So anyway, that's what we're going to be doing. And it's going to be the third weekend next year in September. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So we want to invite everybody out there and come on and do it. Dr. Trey, you got to bring your family. Kyler, you got to bring you and your family. You got to come out and enjoy this crazy time we're going to have in Ruidoso, which is, what is it, John, about an hour from Roswell, but it's a very good road so people can get there easily, right?
It's a fun drive because it's a gorgeous drive, and especially in the summertime when the trees are in bloom. It's not one of those arduous drives where you drive on the straight road through the desert and you got nothing on either side of you. It's so much fun. You're going around these big bends, around these mountains, and the road twists and curves, and the scenery just constantly changes, and it's beautiful. So it's an awesome drive. But I heard earlier Trey said he spent a summer in Ruidoso, so I'd love to hear just a second about that, because I think it's cool you've been there.
Yeah, Trey,
after
tell us about
my first year of medical school. After my first year of medical school, it was 10 months. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and they do a huge, long first year. And then after that, you're in the clinics in your second year. Most schools, you do 2 years of basic sciences, and then you go to clinics. But they start us off early. And after my first year of medical school, I had a little bit of time off, and I arranged to go hang out with the brother of a neighbor of mine when we lived in Northern Virginia. And he was a general practitioner who could do absolutely anything, deliver babies, operate on people, everything. And I got to spend a couple of weeks, including the 4th of July, and it was the coldest place in the country on that day because it's on top of a mountain, and it's the home of the All-American Futurity, a very, very high purse quarter horse race. And it was just a great experience, with this doctor and his family. And I stayed in a little apartment across the street from the hospital. So I was involved in, I was immersed in clinical medicine. It was wonderful.
In Ruidoso, New Mexico. That's great.
The things I remember in particular were the hummingbirds. The doctor's wife had 4 hummingbird feeders, and they would go through at least a gallon of hummingbird feed every day. It was the most amount of hummingbirds I've ever seen at one time. It was a beautiful place, So I think it would be a great place to visit.
Well, that's right, and then we'll have an event there. It'll be a lot of fun. So, Dr. Trey, you're going to be invited. Everyone from Scary Cast will be invited, and I think we're going to have a grand time. And so all I've got to say is, John LeMay, it has been, again, another wonderful time talking with you about your research, about the things that you're doing. You're doing some great things, and we want to thank you very much for being here with us on Scary Cast.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure to come on here.
Well, that's great. And Dr. Trey Donaway, we're glad you were in Ruidoso to tell us about that. And we were glad to have you here. And Kyler, we had a lot of fun. We'll be back now with John in a month. And we'll be back, of course, next week on Scary Cast. And hopefully the queen of Scary Cast, Robin McCrae, will be with us. She's been unavailable today, so we hope she's okay and that everything's all right. So wanted to say thanks to everybody. We've had a great time. We'll see everybody next week on the one, the only Scary Cast. Now everybody, can please say goodbye.
Good night.
Bye, guys.
Goodbye.